Hi, this is Newt. 2020 is going to be one of the most extraordinary election years of our lifetime. I want to invite you to join my inner circle as we discuss each twist and turn in the presidential race in my members-only Inner Circle Club. You'll receive special flash briefings, online events, and members-only audio reports from me and my team. Here is a special offer for my podcast listeners. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. And if you sign up for a 1 or 2 year membership, you'll get 10% off your membership price and a VIP fast pass to my live events. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. Use the code podcast at checkout. Sign up today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast and use the code podcast. Hurry, this offer expires February 14th. On this episode of Newt's World, Calista and I recently visited South Korea on a really rapid trip, which included visiting the capital of Seoul, going up to the demilitarized zone, and visiting the 5G developments at Samsung. It was just a remarkable reminder of what a miracle modern South Korea has become. I felt that in part because my dad served there in 1953 during the war, and then went back later and served in the late 60s. And to see the poverty, the pain, the destruction of the South Korea he served in 1953, and this gigantic city of 10 million, the fourth largest metropolitan area in the world, Seoul today is like a modern miracle, partly a testimony to the South Korean people, partly a testimony to the patience and commitment of the United States. And the Seoul metropolitan area has over 25 million people, about half the population of South Korea. It's fascinating, and I thought worth talking about the Korean peninsula, the whole peninsula, because of some of the contrast between North and South. We're very fortunate to have Dr. Stephen Norper, who's with us today, and who's a real expert on this topic, and is going to help us have a much better sense of understanding. Before we get into Korea, Steve, would you sort of give us a little bit of an introduction? How did you get so interested in Korea?
Well, like you, I was fascinated with the period after the Korean War. I grew up in a family with 5 adopted siblings from Korea. So the memory of the war had some perpetuation through the establishment of the adoption network and a lot of young Korean Americans who made their way here. Identified with a lot of the cultural issues, but actually worked a lot on issues of human rights and political repression. And now I'm at the Korea Society. That's an American NGO based out of New York. So it's been an interesting journey, and I've now spent over 3 decades dealing with Korea on a daily basis, and it's been fascinating.
You know, I guess because I'm a historian both by training and by the way my mind works, I was very struck. Calista and I were in Korea 5 or 6 years ago, and we went to their war museum, which is really quite remarkable. But the centerpiece of their war museum is not the Korean War that we would relate to, but rather a medieval warship which protected Korea in the Middle Ages, because Korea was consistently threatened both by the Japanese and by the Chinese. And so if you don't mind, take us back for a couple minutes into the deeper roots of the Korean experience and what is Koreanness, and how did they emerge surrounded by these two bigger countries and struggling for a unique identity?
Right. It's a great question, because the country came out of a period where there was a Three Kingdoms period, where you had a lot of division, and then entered into the single longest dynastic reality in all of East Asia. They had 13 centuries of essentially being a single dynasty. And as they did that, they did encounter the challenges of their neighbors. It earned it the title Hermit Kingdom in that it appeared to be isolated, but it opened up to the West in the 1880s.
Historically, people who were Korean, as I understand it, took great pride in being Korean, and would all basically have identified as a single unified culture, in contrast to the Russians to the north, or the Siberians actually before the Russians, and then the Chinese to their west, and the Japanese to the east. I mean, is that a reasonable way of describing them?
Certainly the Korean Peninsula has become the destiny for its people, because the mountains meant a more rigorous reality. It's reflected in the durability of the people in terms of the spicy cuisine and in terms of the national character. It has had an amazing amount of resilience. It has had to learn to both repel and adapt to the realities of China to the west and Japan to the east, Russia to the north, and in the modern context, dealing with the Americans and other international interests. So that political reality has also made it extremely adept in terms of what happened after the Korean War, in terms of the stand up in two generations. It's largely a nation defined by the Minjuk, by the ethnicity of the Korean people. So national identity is incredibly important. And as it's become more politically and economically viable, that means that sense of identity has grown with it. And there's a strong sense of pride, which you've detected in your visits.
Starting in the late 1880s, the United States began to open them up from the sea. And in particular, our interests were missionary activities. This was the great wave of American missionaries going to China as well as Korea. I was very struck when Calista became the ambassador to the Vatican. The very first event we went to was a Korean-sponsored series of pictures and paintings and things about Christianity in Korea, the degree of difficulty it faced, and in particular in the north, the degree to which, if it still exists, it exists in the mountains with people who are literally prepared to virtually starve for their religious beliefs. In the south, of course, it became a much bigger part. I think about 5% of Korea is now Christian. And it seems to be a fairly significant piece of the leadership of the country.
It is, and it's been fascinating because Christianity has taken hold in Korea in a way that it clearly hasn't in China or Japan. And while in the late 1800s that missionary activity first met resistance, and there were many missionaries killed in the process of educating and evangelizing, it left a lasting impact in a very positive way in terms of the structure of the educational system. A lot of schools opened in terms of healthcare, hospitals. And so Koreans who at that time were poor and were suffering under Japanese subjugation once the early 20th century came around, it provided an outlet for them, and it provided education, medical care, and support. And as Korea then became liberated after 1945, South Korea became very active. Really, when you land in Seoul, you see, especially at night, lit crosses. It's a city of crosses. And it's interesting that you mentioned North Korea, because people may not realize, but at the turn of the 20th century, Pyongyang was regarded as the Jerusalem of the East. That was the term widely used.
Well, the U.S. had a great deal of missionary activity in Korea that was voluntary. In the end, Korea was not central to the U.S. And in particular, the United States decided that it had other things that were far more important. And as seen by the Koreans, it betrayed them. And could you comment for a second on the impact of the Taft-Katsura Treaty and the whole feeling it created in Korea?
The 1905 Taft-Katsura Agreement essentially was an understanding between the Secretary of War, William Howard Taft, and the Japanese Prime Minister, Katsura, where the Philippines and the control of it was basically traded off to the Americans in exchange for control of Korean Peninsula to Japan. Again, not a formal agreement, but implicitly and in a discussion of broader policy. The Russo-Japanese War had just ended. Japan was in a position of strength. 10 years earlier, it had defeated China in the Sino-Japanese War. So it then began to expand. It was colonial Japan at that point, and it took took Korea in 1905 and formally annexed it in 1910. And that then began an almost four-decade legacy of oppressive colonial occupation, which robbed Koreans of their identity. They lost their names. They had to take Japanese names. They lost their standing. They were forced, many, to exile, to labor in Japan or in very poor conditions in Korea. There were gross human rights abuses. And so this period between the formal annexation in 1910 and liberation after the defeat of Japan in 1945 was one that is remembered by Koreans as a period of tremendous brutality, of a national disgrace and embarrassment, of a foreign occupation.
Then all of a sudden, this remarkably independent country that had been balancing for well over 1,000 years between China and Japan is suddenly overwhelmed by the rise of the modern, industrialized Japanese in 1905. And they really run the country with a ruthlessness that is sort of a foreshadowing of how they will behave in World War II. Can you talk a little bit about the degree to which the Japanese ran the country, the way they did it, and the kind of memories that that has left?
Between 1910 and 1945, Korea was formally annexed as a territory of Japan, and so it was administered by Japan. There was a prefectural government. There were local Japanese administrators. It was run as something of a military-type regime, and the population worked to the benefit of Japan. Most of the economic goods were shipped to Japan. Labor was shipped to Japan, and many Koreans, in the course of losing their identities, then became conscripted laborers in Japan. And it was a poor period for the Koreans. It was also the birth of their independence period, because in 1919, they stood up a large opposition among the students and intelligentsia and labor forces against Japan. And it's one that really was very long, tragic, and cruel in its disposition. And it didn't alleviate itself until 1945. We've just marked the 100th anniversary of the 1919 movement, which was a popular uprising. It was the singular period when the intelligentsia, students, and labor gathered. It was resistance against the Japanese, and it was in that year, too, that there was the evolution of a government in exile, and that was largely won in China. But it was a time of great national suffering, and it was a time of the loss of identity. And Korea was largely seen as a backwater. It was a poor area. It wasn't seen as strategically vital. And the Philippines, on the other hand, provided a more obvious trade entree into Southeast Asia, and it appeared to have more on offer for U.S. economic interests.
I think it's important to remember that the World War was enormous, and that the United States was faced with, they thought, the prospect of invading Japan, which they thought would probably kill 1 million Americans and 7 or 8 million Japanese. And at that point, Stalin offered, having defeated the Germans, that a substantial part of the Soviet army would liberate part of China and part of Korea. And it was in that context of trying to find a balance of power, really, with the Soviet Union, that we ended up deciding that there'd be two Koreas. It raises really interesting questions about whether, for example, if we had said we don't care, you'd have had a totally communist Korea, and that would have been a different world. Or if we had said to the Soviets, we're not going to tolerate you south of the Yalu, that would have led to a different world. But at the time, I think our basic attitude was, look, we've been fighting a big war. We just want to get it over with. The troops want to go home. Let's find some common sense agreement. And you probably had almost nobody who knew anything about Korean history or Korean culture involved in the decision making. And so that was the simplest way to decide it. And at the time, it actually left the North with most of the industry and most of the population and most of the wealth. I mean, people tend to forget now because the situation is so radically different. But it was not clear at all in 1945 that the South could survive economically. Certainly not clear that it would become a democracy in any foreseeable future. Does that strike you as about right?
That's exactly right. And you know, that led to the ambivalence of the Truman administration in terms of how to deal with entry into the Korean War. At the time, the American population thought of Korea as the third conflict after World War I, after World War II. And there were a lot of questions about the willingness to engage in what was seen as a rather far off place, especially after the difficulties of having dealt with the nightmare of Imperial Japan and having ended that with the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and really a lack of a national will to be involved yet again in another conflict as soon as 1950.
I think the shock of the North Koreans coming across the border on June 25th, 1950, and the quality of the North Korean army, which had been developed, Kim Il-sung had been picked by Stalin. He was a anti-Japanese guerrilla fighter who had worked very, very hard to be acceptable as a Stalinist. And so he became the head of North Korea. He was vaguely associated with the communists in China, but the communists in China were seen as not totally regular communists. Stalin had some mild interest in North Korea, and Kim Il-sung sold everybody in a campaign in the winter of 1949, early 1950, literally a campaign to go out and convince both Stalin and Mao Zedong that North Korea could unify the country, that the Americans clearly would not intervene, and that it would consolidate communism on the Asian continent. He had a commitment of some support from Stalin, although it was always dubious because Stalin was very hard to pin down. And he had a commitment which Stalin had leaned on Mao to get, of some possible support from Mao. Although the primary reason the Chinese would come into the war was that they were not going to tolerate the Americans being that close to the mainland.
Well, no, you're right. And that's a fundamentally important period, because what happened in March of 1949 was Kim Il-sung went to Moscow and tried to appeal to Stalin and say, look, I'd like your support to unify the Korean Peninsula. And Stalin really didn't have interest. It was only a year and a month later, in April of 1950, that Stalin signaled that this was permissible. And there were really a couple of factors that played into mind. One was that the Chinese civil war had essentially ended with the PRC in control. And so with mainland China more unified, Stalin saw an opportunity to also peg Russian interests. Secondly, the Soviets had developed their own atomic capability. And so with the Soviet bomb, it felt bullish, and it felt that it could be more expansionary. And that then created the concern in the United States about the domino effect and trying to curtail the forward role of communism. All those factors come into play that in a very unhealthy way then lead to Kim Il-sung feeling empowered in June of 1950 to roll forward over the 38th parallel after some skirmishes by both North and South. There was a Russian protectorate that grew up north of the 38th parallel and an American protectorate that grew up south of the 38th parallel. How did they arrive at that? Two colonels in Washington, D.C. They essentially threw a dart at the board, and that was what stuck. And that's how the Koreans, certainly those of a more nationalistic orientation, see it when they are concerned about the division of the peninsula. But let's remember, the division of the Korean Peninsula may well have been a result of U.S. and Soviet determination, and that became what is essentially the area that after the Korean War in 1953 was marked off as the demilitarized zone.
When we come back.
It's one of the more definitive and fascinating areas of U.S. military history.
The Korean War itself is an amazing period, because we clearly were unprepared. We had too small a unit in Japan. They were too badly trained. They were under-equipped. We'd really relaxed dramatically from 1945 after winning World War II. And yet we were able, between June 25th and early September, to stop the North Koreans around the Pusan perimeter, organize an amphibious landing, and land at Incheon behind the North Koreans, cutting off their logistics and collapsing their army. And what's one of the most classic campaigns in history, matched then by the hubris of Douglas MacArthur, who had launched the campaign brilliantly and then sort of became blinded by his own success and refused to believe that the Chinese communists would come in and set up a stunning moment of total strategic surprise in November of 1950 that led to one of the largest American defeats in history. To me, it's an amazing, that whole process in 1950 is just astonishing.
You're absolutely right, Newt. It's one of the more definitive and fascinating areas of U.S. military history. Clearly, the fact that they were able to push back from the perimeter really showed an incredible amount of resolve. The fact that Incheon took place 100 miles north of North Korean lines was a remarkable accomplishment and what they achieved, and the roll up to the Yalu. But MacArthur wanted to keep forces that far north, but clearly the rollback by the Truman administration toward the 38th parallel then meant that all of that activity that you saw there in the first year led to a following 2 years of relative stalemate, and then eventually the armistice in 1953. But you note what happened in December of 1950, the first mass evacuation under the auspices of the United Nations, the U.S. led, from Hungnam. And the current president, Moon Jae-in's parents were part of the Hungnam evacuation. Stunning. Now, a million Koreans today owe their lineage to those who were evacuated from Hungnam, over 112,000 people. Just a remarkable effort and feats of tremendous bravery on small vessels that made their way out, including a ship of miracles that saw a resolute Korean stand for 3 or 4 days before they reached their destination, that saw multiple berths on board and an amazing degree of civility, pride, and stoicism, and tremendous heroics by United States forces as they had to evacuate out of the Chosun Reservoir and as they made their way to Hungnam and then south, and tremendous loss of American life to protect those refugees, many of whom have gone on to help build modern Korea as it is today.
Do you have any idea what share of the North Korean population voluntarily went south?
A lot of North Koreans did go south, and that's why two-thirds of the peninsula in terms of population are in the south and only a third in the north.
So when the war gradually grinds to a halt, partially because we prove we're determined enough to stop the Chinese, and the Chinese feel like they've sort of made their point that they won't let us go north, and Eisenhower, in all probability, communicated through the Indians that if he had to, he would go to nuclear weapons. At that point, there is an armistice, which, when we were visiting recently, it's amazing to realize, technically, there's still an armistice. I mean, technically, they're still at war, and that the armistice has been holding now for 63 years, which strikes me as sort of an astonishing comment on the world, that you could have this not war, not peace relationship.
Right, the stalemate, and it's one where the armistice, you know, really was by design only meant to last for a very short time, weeks or a few months. But as you mentioned, it has stretched itself out now towards seven decades and has left a relatively stable situation. I mean, save for some flare-ups along the demilitarized zone and along the northern limit line out in the West Sea over time, but it has been a relatively stable fixture. The United States is a signatory, as is North Korea. China managed to skirt. Mao was clever in terms of having it signed only by Chinese voluntary army, which gives them some of an out. But in the eventual resolution, clearly China will probably have to step up with any peace mechanism that's put in place. But South Korea, interestingly, chose not to sign it because Syngman Rhee, the president, was vociferous in his opposition to not uniting the Korean Peninsula. And so South Korea technically is not a signatory. But what Moon Jae-in, the president now, would like to do is very much have North, South, the United States, and China in some place highly symbolic to sign something of an end of war statement, and beyond that, a peace treaty that replaces the armistice.
Tell me about how the Kims came to power.
There was a civil conflict taking place on the peninsula, and so the Kim family emerged first with Kim Il-sung, who became the leader with the imposition and support by Stalin. And Kim Il-sung had been a colonial fighter, and he used that legitimacy in the fight against the Japanese to rally support in his contest for leadership. And then really you have the growth of the cult of the Kim family. It was Kim Il-sung who then maintained control until his death in 1994. And then that continues through his son after 1994 when Kim Jong-il enters onto the scene more fully. He had been groomed for a long period to succeed his father. And you have not only a communist succession, as it were, but really more a Confucian dynastic succession. And then that continues through his excesses. And you may recall that Kim Jong-il was guilty of terrorist incidents and, again, gross human rights abuses and mounting a very serious security challenge as he had his military first agenda. And then now, since his passing in 2011, the assumption of power by Kim Jong-un, who has emerged on the one hand as more of a seemingly globally inclined leader. He seems to like the stage more than his father, although that is more a phenomenon of the last year or two. But the repression has not subsided, and the gulag still exists with as many as 120,000 North Koreans in detention camps with a very serious security challenge, which has been the preeminent concern. It was the one passed from the Obama to Trump administrations in a December 2016 classified briefing and has been defined by the Trump administration as the dominant national security concern, and that is the missile and nuclear improvements, enhancements by North Korea, and now a very lethal range in its weaponry and capabilities with the ability to strike the entire continental U.S. Through the development of ICBMs and with a very strong nuclear capability. The sixth test, which was concluded in September 2 years ago, had a yield of 270 kilotons, or about 17 times the size of Hiroshima. So tremendous lethality. And that is what the United States and international community are bent on doing now, is to curb North Korean developments on the nuclear and missile front. And there's a long list of other concerns, to include human rights.
When we come back,
the model of Korea as a harbinger for democracy in a time of rising autocracy, Korea is really essentially important.
You have two radically different systems. You have one which is a totalitarian dictatorship, deliberately isolated from the world and representing a level of poverty that's unbelievable. And you have one which is a democracy with a very vibrant civil society and engaged worldwide in commercial development. And you can, the easiest way to summarize it is to look at a map at night where you can see where the boundary is, because south of the boundary there's all sorts of electric lights of a prosperous, free South Korea, and north of the boundary there are almost no electric lights because they're so poverty-stricken in the dictatorship. There are very few places on the planet where you have as stark and clear a distinction between North and South Korea. And what makes it really dangerous is that the North does have nuclear weapons, and even before it had nuclear weapons, it has probably 250,000 artillery pieces and missiles that are within reach of Seoul. Seoul's the fourth largest urban area in the world, and very, very vulnerable to a North Korean first strike, even with conventional weapons. So you have a balance of prosperity versus tyranny. That always makes it dangerous, although so far the North Korean dictatorship's desire to survive has kept it relatively stable and relatively risk-avoiding, I think, would be my guess. But what would you say, Stephen?
That's exactly right, and that's a brilliant summary. The South Koreans really present us with so many testimonials and opportunities, one to the strength of the U.S.-Korea alliance and what that has meant in terms of U.S. alliance relationships with not only the security relationship, but with heavy AID investment and with business investment over time. Korea mobilizing itself through the strength of its people over two generations to really the economic powerhouse it is now, to now be the 10th largest global economy with brands like Samsung, Hyundai, and LG, winning through its soft power, hearts and minds globally, clearly the strength of Korean film, K-pop, and other things that have appeal. And then very importantly, to myself as a political scientist, the model of Korea as a harbinger for democracy in a time of rising autocracy and rollbacks to democracy. And so Korea is really essentially important. It is modeled for other places like Mongolia in terms of its democratic transition. And it's an important place in the Asia Pacific for staking democratic values. And then in contrast, you really do have this stark totalitarian government in the north. And while much of the popular media lately has focused on the young leader and with some fascination, and there has generally been a mythology with global interest around the Kim family and all of its oddness and all its cultish behavior, it's a very serious challenger on the international stage in terms of the conventional force threat, in terms of missiles and nukes, chemical and biological, in terms of human rights concerns, in terms of its challenges as a developmental state where 80% of its population is living in abject poverty, where basic agriculture, energy, foodstuff, and healthcare needs are not being met, where the United Nations is making broad appeals because of challenges, natural disasters, and challenges on the health front, where things like tuberculosis and multi-strain resistant tuberculosis are an increasing reality, which has a transnational aspect, which presents a challenge in the event of political instability by way of tumult and potential for outflows of refugees and the pandemics that follow them, and questions about control of the nuclear stockpile, issues of nuclear safety. And importantly, things like cybercrime today, where the North Koreans derive over $1 billion annually in revenues from cyber theft, and where to employ your most recent podcast, where you have 5G miracles in South Korea, and you have a nation that as of December 1st had three carriers. Within 6 months, we'll have nationwide 5G coverage that is sophisticated and wired beyond any other place on Earth, and it was the first nation in the Asia Pacific to enter onto the 5G scene. And then you have the cyber criminals in North Korea mounting their attacks from both within North Korea as well as from within China. So it's a tremendous challenge in many, many areas, security, political, economic, and otherwise. And that is why it's received so much focus and why the summitry, too, that has gone on in recent months has derived a great deal of international attention, why the sanctions regime is in place to curtail the missile and nuclear developments.
Let me ask you sort of a summary question. Given all of your years of experience, as you look down the road, would you describe yourself as an optimist or a pessimist? First, reach some kind of stabilizing agreement on weapons, and second, actually begin to see the North Korean regime evolve towards a more prosperous and more humane system?
I see myself as very much a cautious optimist. I think there's tremendous potential, part of which is in the character of the Korean people and in what we've seen by way of their adaptability, their flexibility, and the rise of South Korea. As much as the international media says, what's the model for North Korea? Is it China? Is it Vietnam or elsewhere? Really, the best model is to the south of the demilitarized zone, and they will look there for South Korean investment and opportunity as the Moon Jae-in administration continues its path toward inter-Korean reconciliation. We've had important progress in the last year, including the opening of communications hotlines and the destruction of some of the guard posts along the demilitarized zone. Just in December, you had North and South Korean troops walking together, smoking, conversing as they inspected those destroyed North Korean outposts. You've had a moratorium in place by North Korea. I think ultimately North Koreans, because they consider themselves strategically isolated and because they are economically disadvantaged, will come to the table on this. I think that the challenge for the international community is convincing Kim Jong-un that security is not derived from having the weaponry in place, but security is derived from giving up that weaponry and realizing the economic opportunities that have been put forward by the South Korean United States administrations, as well as by the international community, and its encouragement for North Korea to embrace a more peaceful path. In terms of the question, though, about its ability to become softer and gentler, there will be questions. If it modifies itself, it is doing that for regime survivability purposes. It's a conservative, little c, conservative impulse to maintain itself, to maintain the Kim family legacy. So I would argue against Kim Jong-un as a great economic reformer or a visionary that way. I think he's tacking. He's younger. Through the guise of a 35-year-old man, he's trying to adapt the nation to a reality that's more economically vibrant. He no doubt realizes he has an economic basket case outside of Pyongyang and needs international support in a lessening of sanctions. Part of what happens in a Confucian system, and we should think of this less as a communist regime and much more as a Confucian dynastic regime, is that he is accountable to the people. There's an accountability factor, and he has to provide for the generals who have been on the take in this kleptocracy, for the business leaders who are now emerging, and the supposed rising middle class, and for young North Koreans. And young North Koreans are more concerned about mobile phones and mobility, and they're hearing a message about life in South Korea, about a better world. So the question then becomes, how long can they maintain that facade? When will there be cracks in the veneer? And do information flows finally make a difference where, when the economy improves, you have rising expectations? And Newt, as a historian, you well know, it's when the economies are rising that revolutions happen. And will there ultimately be political change? And that's not factored in very well in a lot of analyses today because of the concern, be it warranted, with the security challenges. But we need to see this in a much broader light, because what we want eventually is some sort of peaceful integration. And the Korean people want an integration and a unification. But younger South Koreans are concerned about economic slowdown. They're concerned about job opportunities. And there has been a shift in the political scene that reflects that. So gradual integration seems to be what we're hearing in terms of the bent of both South and North Korea that plays out over time, that allows for economic inputs to lessen the burden, because it will be a very expensive and complex process. And beyond that, if there's sudden upheaval in the North, which is within the realm of possibility, if there are pockets of resistance after these purges, if there are rises in expectations and eventually over time in social movements, then it's anyone's guess. And that, too, will have tremendous demands on the United States and on the international community. So this is a complex process. So the Korean War years have had a legacy. And while it has been relatively stable, and while South Korea has emerged as a vibrant political and economic model, there will be challenges ahead as it figures out how to integrate North Korea. But ultimately, I'm optimistic, because a united Korea will be a powerful entity that will have 60-plus million people. And once they have weathered the changes that are required and the economic inputs that will be necessary, will be an important player, perhaps along the line of a France or Germany in the Asia Pacific. And it will be a different world. And it's good to maintain that U.S.-Korea relationship in a very positive light, because it will be ultimately in America's interest, whether it's sharing in technology and 5G, whether it is the democratic values that are shared and economic prosperity and stability, because only around the Korean Peninsula do the first, second, third, and tenth largest economies in our world meet.
Like you, I think I am moderately optimistic. Hey, I think unification is probably a very long way off, but I think gradual reduction of the tyranny, gradual opening up of the North, and a sense of prosperity being actually possible is very realistic in the next decade. And I suspect that Kim Jong-un is faced with extraordinarily complicated balancing act between an old order, which has sacrificed for its entire lifetime to be an isolated hermit dictatorship with no hope of breaking out, and the realistic, I think, sense that the world is passing them by, and that the gap is now so enormous that they've got to find some way to give the people hope and to find a model that doesn't give up the dictatorship, but that does make it possible for it to start evolving into the modern world. So certainly I think the folks like my father who fought there in the 50s would be amazed and delighted to visit Seoul, Korea today and realize how much had grown up behind our shield and how much the people that they had helped and worked and fought beside had created a better future in Korea. And I think that we might get to the next stage in the next generation. So I want to thank you for sharing with us your expertise and your knowledge. And I think it's very helpful for people who are trying to get a better context to understand everything that's going on between the United States and North Korea.
Well, thank you, Newt, and thanks for the sacrifice of your father and so many others. And you're right, it's been an impressive and amazing development on the Korean Peninsula, and it's one where we do have a real stake, and we have a stake going forward. So let's hope for again, peace, prosperity, a reduction of tensions, and eventually liberation for the people of the northern half of the peninsula, because they deserve nothing less in this modern era than the peace and prosperity that their brothers and sisters to the south well enjoy.
Thank you to my guest, Dr. Stephen Norper. You can see the books, articles, and documents that we relied on in researching this episode on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Westwood One. The executive producer is Debbie Myers. Our producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our editor is Robert Borowski. Our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. The music was composed by Joey Salvia. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360 and Westwood One's Tim Sabian and Robert Mathers. Please email me with your comments at newt@newtsworld.com. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what Newt's World is all about. On the next episode of Newt's World, I'll be presenting another episode of The Immortals. You'll remember we've already talked about George Washington and Julius Caesar. This time, I'm going to tell the story of Benjamin Franklin, a man who personified the American dream. Someone who, at a very young age, went from Boston to Philadelphia, apprenticed under his uncle to be a printer, turned out in the end to be a great businessman, a scientist, one of the leading scientists in the world, a politician, a diplomat, participated in writing the Constitution, participated in writing the Declaration of Independence, represented the United States in France, a man of great passion, intelligence, energy, drive, and toughness. I think you'll find Ben Franklin very interesting. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.